Everyone, there's a lot going on in the building today, so we're having trouble rounding up the herds of cats here. So we will start today with a work session on House Bill 2382 that we had an extensive hearing on yesterday. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2382 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2382 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. I will carry that. Okay, now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2131. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Address Confidentiality Program, or ACP, was established by the legislature in 2005. It enables victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking to keep their addresses and telephone numbers confidential. It also allows participants to use a substitute address when working with state and local government agencies. House Bill 2131A expands the definition of actual address in the ACP to include the participant's county of residence and election precinct. It allows participants to use a substitute address when the law requires the disclosure of a residence. It requires public bodies to adopt policies preventing the disclosure of actual addresses or telephone numbers to their employees. It also permits the Oregon Department of Transportation to issue licenses or identification cards, and participants to apply for licenses or identification cards without disclosing the actual addresses. There also are amendments to this bill, which I've only recently seen, so if the proponents could testify as to what those amendments do, the committee would appreciate that.
Okay. We have Senator Devlin, Cynthia Stinson, and Sybil Hebb. Looks like everybody's in favor. Why don't you all come up together? Welcome.
Still looking for stuff.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, do you have the amendments to House Bill 2131?
I see them. I looked there in my file.
What number is it? I've got a
2131.
I've got an 18.
Yeah.
That should be in the package.
I put it in the wrong bill. And then I put it in the wrong bill file. That's all right.
Okay, welcome. Senator Devlin, why don't you start?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I'm glad to be here today before you to testify in favor of House Bill 2131. This bill and its amendment provides some necessary technical changes to the Address Confidentiality Program in the Department of Justice. Oregon adopted its Address Confidentiality Program in the 2005 session. My memory is correct, I think, with only one or two no votes between both chambers. We were the 17th to adopt this program. The state of Washington was actually the first in 1989. The Address Confidentiality Program provides much-needed protection for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking who have relocated to escape severe abuse. In fact, I can remember that in some earlier testimony in the earlier session, some of these victims actually live in fear that the next time they open their door might be the last time that they open their door. A victim who is relocated to a safe place is often at risk of being tracked by an abuser through the state's public records. These records can be used to find a victim's new residential address. This can put the victim at renewed risk and both abuse and extreme violence. The Address Confidentiality Program increases victim safety by keeping residential addresses out of the public records when their safety is at risk. The bill has had broad bipartisan support in the last legislative session, and I believe still has the support of all of these parties. It was supported by the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Oregon Judicial Department, and the Oregon Department of Justice. Representative of these agencies and more currently form the task force that's been involved in implementation of the program. As the program has been implemented, a few minor loopholes have been discovered. HB 2131 provides technical fixes so as to allow better implementation of the protections envisioned in the creation of the Address Confidentiality Program. I urge your support for this bill in the name of the protection for victims who have fled severe violence in search of their safety. Ms. Stinson will explain both the bill and the amendments. I would be remiss if I didn't state here that I'm very proud of the work that was done on this bill, but just so that I can embarrass her further, my former chief of staff, Shelby Rahala, I believe is in the audience, who now works for Washington County and incidentally is probably paid far more than I could ever afford to pay her. And she did the majority of the work behind the scenes. And when you look at all the technical issues that you have to address in this kind of program, she did a remarkable job.
She's sitting in the second row with the red face. Good work, Shelby. Thank you, Senator Devlin. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you. The shorter you can keep it, the better. Senator Devlin did a good job summarizing. Thank you.
My name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Department of Justice Crime Victims Assistance Section. And as Senator Devlin said, House Bill 2131A is a conglomeration of technical fixes that came about as an advisory committee that was helping us start this program and get it up and online January 1, 2007, worked on these issues and found that there were some loopholes in the protections for victims that were unintended in the passage of the original legislation. So working together with our advisory committee, the bill is a compilation of those changes and fixes to those loopholes. I will point out just the major changes, and they are in the written testimony there also. The key points of the legislation include a change to the voter registration records, and it allows that a participant's voting precinct and county be exempt from publicly available voting information. This is because we realized that even though we had been able to exempt the actual address of the participant from voting records, that when a voting record was printed out, including many voters, the victim's name and the county and the precinct would show up so that if there someone were looking for them, it would give very clear clues as to where their location, where they were located. So this piece was suggested in conjunction with the Secretary of State's office, and as you see, there's a zero fiscal impact
and,
on this.
And we have your written testimony, so if you could just really summarize very briefly.
Second major change, disclosure of participant information, also helps with safety for victims by requiring a court order signed by a judge after a finding of good cause before DOJ releases actual address information of a participant. Section 11 pertains to DMV records. That language adds that participants can have the ACP address show up on their ID and driver's license. We had intended in the original bill to have all records be able to have DMV records to have the participant's ACP address on them, and we discovered late in the process that we had forgotten the registration records. So the amendment, the 2131A2 that you've just seen and I've just seen, it just came out hot off the presses, addresses that tiny loophole. So we had intended always to allow ACP participants to have their substitute address on driver's licenses, ID cards, and registration materials. And so this amendment in combination with the others in the bill and the engrossed version complete that puzzle for DMV records. And finally, sections 14 and 15 pertain to jury pool information. Again, one of our partners, the Oregon Judicial Department, suggested this, and we worked with them on this change that allows ACP participants to be exempt from jury lists used by the courts and from the lists delivered to political parties. So there are several smaller adjustments in the bill that are technical in nature, but those are the highlights.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Hebb.
For the record, Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, also in support of this bill, and I echo the comments that have been made by those before me and just appreciate the committee's attention to this.
Now, in your work group, did you have anybody from the newspaper publishers or the open government types? I see people in the audience.
We did not.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes.
They were actually had no problem with the original bill back in 2005. They were one of the parties that actually hadn't expressed any concern about the bill, the original bill. I wanted to state also, just so it's understood, in terms of these modifications, what we were talking about here in terms of when this is, when we get up to the level that we anticipate being at, we're talking about probably approximately 250 individuals, which will probably be another year or two, which is about where a state of our size would end up under this kind of program. But these are individuals that actually fear for their life is what it basically comes down to. So these exemptions, while they sound broad, they're actually trying to protect some very people that are in a very difficult situation. And we're actually only talking about 250 participants. So anybody that's worried about these not showing up in terms of a printed list of voters, we're not talking about very many people. And quite honestly, that they're still voting and all that, those records are still documented. It's just they're not going to release it to the public where they live.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2131 and open a work session on House Bill 2131. Senator Barr.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2131.
Senator Byer has moved the Dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2131. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2131 as amended to the floor to do fast recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2131A as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Devlin, would you like to carry this? So done. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2324. Is that correct? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2324A would enact the, quote, capable of repetition but evading review exception to the mootness doctrine. And I will let the proponents describe in more detail what that means.
Okay. We have a distinguished panel of Charles Hinkle, Phil Schradl, and Andrea Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charles Hinkle. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I have submitted written testimony, and I'll summarize it very briefly. The problem that this bill addresses is as follows. Students in a high school want to have public prayer, a prayer session in the corridor of the school. That's happened in Vancouver a month or so ago. Or students in another high school object to having graduation prayer. They take their cases respectively to court. They graduate. Though in Oregon, then the Oregon Supreme Court will not decide the constitutionality of their challenge because in the Oregon Supreme Court's view, the case is moot. These particular students won't be affected anymore. The case gets dismissed and the question is not resolved. The issue arises in election law cases. The Secretary of State has to decide when he receives an initiative petition, does this comply with the full text rule of the Constitution? Full text rule is interpreted one way by the Department of Justice. It's interpreted another way by private citizens. They go to court over it. A trial court rules. The election then passes, and the Oregon Supreme Court refuses to decide the issue. The Secretary of State is left up in the air. What does the full text requirement mean? How is the Secretary supposed to enforce it in the future? The issue arises in many administrative areas. The Liquor Control Commission may suspend a liquor license for 60 days. The City of Portland may issue an exclusion order telling someone they can't go into a public park for 30 days. The affected parties challenge that in court. The 60 days passes, the 30 day passes. The 30 days pass, they get up to the Oregon Supreme Court. Oregon Supreme Court says, we don't have a live controversy anymore. The issue is moot. We won't decide the legality or the lawfulness of that particular license suspension or the exclusion ordinance. And so public officials once again are left in the dark. Is the exclusion ordinance valid or not? How can we enforce it in the future? We don't know because the Oregon Supreme Court won't tell us. Starting in 1895, the courts of New York solved that problem by saying when an issue presents a matter of public importance that will recur, we will decide the case even though the particular litigant in front of us no longer has an interest. The election has already passed, so this candidate, it doesn't matter to him or her anymore whether or not they got the right number of signatures or got the right form of initiative petition on the ballot. It's moot as to them, but it's a recurring issue. The next candidate wants to know. The next initiative petitioner wants to know. The next school board wants to know for the next graduation, can we have prayer or not? The next school board wants to know, can we censor this student publication or not? These kids have graduated, yes, but the issue is going to recur. So this doctrine of allowing courts to decide cases that raise questions of public importance, that recur, but that have a short time span with respect to any individual litigant, the courts can go ahead and decide those kinds of questions, as I said, emerged in state courts in 1895 in New York. The U.S. Supreme Court adopted a similar principle in 1911, that's the capable of repetition, yet evading review standard that Mr. Kalmanson mentioned, and since then every state in the Union has adopted that same principle. The Oregon Supreme Court adopted it in 1947 and followed it for the next 35 years or so. There was a sudden change in direction in the 1980s, and the Oregon Supreme Court now, alone of all the courts in the country, refuses to allow this doctrine. It leaves the law in a state of uncertainty, which serves nobody's purpose. So this bill, 2324, is an attempt to solve the problem by saying that courts do have continuing jurisdiction to decide these recurring questions of public importance, provided that the litigant who first came to court had standing, had a personal interest in it, but the fact that his license suspension has expired or her or she has graduated from high school, that won't prevent the court from deciding the issue because it is a recurring one that's going to affect hundreds and thousands of Oregonians in the future. The Oregon Supreme Court decided a case called Kellis last year. It's cited on page 6 of my memorandum under paragraph 6 that seems to suggest that the legislature has the power to adopt this kind of restorative measure to solve this problem, this kind of remedial measure, that's the word I was looking for, to solve a problem that the court has created. So I don't know of any organized opposition to this. People on all sides of the political spectrum, government officials certainly recognize the need to get a resolution of these issues, and this will provide a vehicle for doing that. So I urge the committee to support it.
Mr. Hinkle, what happened in the 80s? Was there a particular case that reversed course on this?
It was a series of cases in which the court began to say, well, we know that for many years now we have decided these cases under this rubric that every other court recognizes, but we have doubts as to whether or not we should continue to do that. And then in 2004, the Oregon Supreme Court, in a case called Yancey v. Schatzer, in a 5-2 vote, said we will not, from now on, decide these cases. We don't have the power to do it.
And were they going back to the original constitutional interpretation?
Yes, they said that they thought that that's what the Constitution meant in 1857. It was a question of what does the phrase judicial power mean? Because the Constitution gives the judicial power to the courts. So do the courts have the judicial power, quote unquote, to decide these kinds of cases? As I said, the U.S. Supreme Court and the highest court of every other state has concluded that the judicial power includes the power to decide these kinds of cases. So the Oregon Supreme Court has a unique and extremely idiosyncratic view of what the term judicial power means, and really not supported by the history in 1857.
Well, because if the Yancey case went back to a constitutional interpretation, is it adequate to fix it with a statute?
Well, that's why I cited the Kellis case there on page 6, Madam Chairman, because the court in the Kellis case just last year said that you no longer have to have a personal stake in the outcome. I quote the exact language there, a personal interest in the outcome of a case to have standing to pursue a case and get a judgment on the merits. And I think that's an invitation. The court there, in effect, said it's up to the legislature to decide the scope of standing and justiciability. This bill, 2324, addresses mootness rather than standing, but they are just, those two concepts are part of a single continuum. What does a court have to have in front of it in order to decide the merits of a case? Does there have to be a live controversy in which the court's decision will have a practical effect on the particular litigant in front of it? In the Kellis case, the Oregon Supreme Court said no, that the legislature has the authority to expand concepts of standing. And I believe, therefore, that that same principle would apply to mootness. And that's why I think 2324... not ideal. I would prefer to have a constitutional amendment to really put the nail in the coffin. But absent that, I think this is the next best thing. And I think under Kellis, it will work.
Fascinating issue. Are there questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. If you would prefer a constitutional solution, why didn't you seek that?
Well, you should ask Mr. Kalmanson that. I did seek it, and I think there was just some feeling that the legislature might have a full plate of constitutional amendments that it wants to refer and shouldn't muddy the ballot.
So this, if this goes through, then you won't need a constitutional amendment unless the court strikes this one down. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, someone at some point will invoke this statute then, and we'll say the next high school graduation class. Yes, I've graduated, but I need to know, can we have prayer in the corridor, or can we have our Bible study or not? And this is under 2334. You, the Oregon Supreme Court, should decide that even though we've already graduated. The court may say no, 2324 is unconstitutional because it goes beyond what we held in the ANSI case. But under Kellis, I think the court will say no, we recognize that the legislature does have the power to define and even to expand concepts of justiciability, and they'll let it fly. If not, then 4, 5, 6, 8 years from now, we'll be back trying to convince Mr. Kalmanson for a constitutional amendment.
Same panel, huh? Other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Hinkle, have you seen the Dash 3 amendments?
Yes, and they appear to me to be simply wording changes, and I don't object to them.
But you support them?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Meyer.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director of the ACLU of Oregon, here today in support of House Bill 2324. The results under the current standard are at best delay of a decision, and at worst, costly litigation for all sides and a delay of justice. And Mr. Hinkle quite articulately described our concerns, and we urge you to move forward with this today. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Mr. Schradl.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Philip Schradl, special counsel to the Attorney General. We're also supportive of this as a public policy matter. I think I would be remiss if I didn't, alert the court, as Mr. Hinkle did, to the fact that there are potentially constitutional challenges that could be brought to this. As Chair Burdick was questioning Mr. Hinkle, the United States v. Schatzer case decided by the Supreme Court just a couple years ago was based on constitutional power, constitutional doctrine under the judicial power in the Oregon Constitution. And as Mr. Hinkle said, I think his preference would be to be able to establish by constitutional amendment this as a public policy. But the question before you really is whether this should be attempted by a statutory proposal. And we had suggested some ways of limiting this a bit, part of which were accomplished in the Dash A3 amendments. And those are a little bit more than just wordsmithing, but primarily wordsmithing. And there's also, just for your consideration, that there, but you know, not, we wouldn't insist upon this in order to support the bill, but we have proposed on the House side that there would be a possible narrowing of the bill to if capable of repetition was with respect to this particularized individual. That concept is not included in the Dash A3 amendments. That would be a way of making this a bit more defensible or strongly defensible in terms of the constitutionality. I'm not suggesting that our office wouldn't defend to the utmost the proposal that you have in front of you. And the House Judiciary Committee declined to go that direction, and so consequently it's over here with that proposal. As a public policy matter, the state is willing not only to abide by the increased litigation that we might see, but there are state interests involved that could be serviced and furthered as well. There are circumstances, as Mr. Hinkle points out, that the legal issue that is of public importance simply can't get addressed because of the fleeting nature of the harm that might flow. And the Yancey versus Schatzer case is a perfect example. It was an exclusionary order that expired by its own terms, I believe, within 30 days. And it's virtually impossible to get an appellate court ruling on that, the constitutionality of that statute within that time frame. So as a public policy matter, we fully endorse that this would be a good public policy to adopt. We will certainly be more than willing to defend, and so we encourage the conversation here to occur, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about that.
How do you define a particularized individual? Are you talking about that very same person, or are you talking about a class of people?
Chair Burdick, the proposal, the language that we hastily crafted on the House side was for that particular person. And that comports fairly closely with the federal standard as to when capable of repetition but evading review will be authorized, and those kinds of claims will be heard in the federal court system. And it has a bit more, I think, of a basis for an understanding that there's a concrete harm that is present and a concrete adversariness between the party litigants in that litigation. As you move away from that same individual being susceptible to the same harm, then it's a harder argument to make that it's a concrete enough adversarial position that it suffices to satisfy the adversarial nature of the judicial power. It is there to adjudicate cases. And again, I'm not suggesting that we cannot defend the current proposal. We certainly would be more than willing to do so.
Because it seems to me that narrow interpretation, for example, in the exclusionary zone, if you had somebody who moved out of state, for example, this current version, you could still litigate that. But under your interpretation, if they moved out of state, then it couldn't apply to them, therefore you couldn't do it.
Chair Burdick, that's exactly right. The tension is between enacting a statute that clearly will be constitutional under the Oregon Supreme Court's interpretation and how the breadth of the kinds of issues that you want to have within that doctrine. And all I'm suggesting is the narrower it is, the easier it is to defend under the Oregon Constitution, the broader it is, the more difficult it becomes.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. So I see this as the legislative branch would be statutorily increasing the power of the judicial branch. What are the chances the judicial branch say, no, we don't want the power?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, let me take a stab at that in the first instance. We have litigated in a number of contexts. In fact, we litigated the Kellos decision. We litigated in Just versus City of Lebanon. And in the Utsi case, that the legislative authority to confer standing, to address mootness, to confer address ripeness, is virtually plenary. And the Supreme Court has not been willing yet to go along with that theory. It's an interesting conundrum because in a way you're putting your finger on an important idea that. Why would you ever turn down additional authority? And I think they feel compelled by their understanding of the constitutional terminology.
Other questions? Mootness. Thank you very much. We have Justice Lindy who would like to testify.
Yes, thank you. I'm Hans Lindy, formerly on the Supreme Court, longtime professor in this field of law.
You have to pull that microphone a little closer.
I must say, I've been very much impressed by how well prepared you people already are on understanding what these issues are. Did any of you actually get a memo from me that has that, it was sort of distributed before the meeting a couple of days ago? Let me say, I have no stake in this. I thought I should point out that the policy that we are all agreeing would be a good policy may be set back by this particular bill rather than further by it. I think it's got nothing to do with what the prior cases say. I'll mention a few things about those. But to tell a court, we want you to do something that you have half a dozen times said you don't do and you don't want to do, is really asking for being turned down. This is their business, and they probably are not going to be terribly happy at being told that something about the way they conduct themselves. Now, let me tell you why that is. There's a long-standing notion that the court should not give advisory opinions, even if they're told to do so by the court, by the legislature. About 22, 23 years ago, the legislature said that they wanted to establish the constitutionality of a damage cap in malpractice cases, and any person could sue the director of insurance or somebody to establish the constitutionality or not of this particular bill, so that people would know whether they were going to be immune from liability or not. And the court said, no, you can't do that. You cannot, by statute, tell us to decide a case that's not only a lawsuit between two parties. Somebody has to get a judgment at the end of the trial. And if the person who, the plaintiff, is no longer interested in a judgment, it's a fiction, an obvious, an intended fiction, to say, well, nevertheless, we will let the judgment go forward in favor of somebody who no longer has any stake in the case, doesn't care about it, doesn't want to do it. As I say, I'm basically in favor of accomplishing what the bill seeks to do. I'm afraid that with the obvious concern that the court has shown over the last few years about how far can we extend our jurisdiction, how far can the legislature extend our jurisdiction, we think they're constitutional obstacles. All of these problems, if you tell them to do something in terms that says do it the way the feds do it, I don't think that's likely to be a successful thing. And then they may write an opinion that will make it impossible to do the problem correctly. Now, there is a correct way to do this. And that is not to treat it as a problem of mootness at all, but to create standing. The people who are interested in these things, after a plaintiff has given up, no longer interested, is dead. You know, that isn't the person who cares about the outcome. It's the people behind that person who identify that person as a suitable plaintiff, who want to continue and then get an adjudication. And the governments, as you've heard, often want an adjudication. But a fictitious adjudication between people who are not parties is going to make that's not something the court's going to want to do. And so there's a better way to do this.
How could someone establish standing when they didn't know whether they'd be affected?
That is something the legislature can do. And the way the legislature can do it, and I'll come back to this Keller's opinion in a minute and explain something to you, but the way you can do that is simply to recognize that people as citizens have interests other than their own personal self-interest, that they have interests that they can get together on and say, we are here to represent our joint priorities with respect to an important public issue. They can continue. They can continue doing this. All I'm asking you to think about in realistic terms is who's the adversary party against the government once the plaintiff is gone, moved out of state, is dead, or whatever? That person isn't the interested party anymore. So who is the interested party? Who is it that's going to get the judgment? And then giving a judgment to this named plaintiff is fully recognized to be a fiction. Well, courts don't like to be told to engage in fictitious lawsuits. So I think that the real difficulty you've got is to try to ram a solution down the court's throat that it has already rejected several times. Now, let me say something historically. It simply isn't the case that there were many cases in which the court previously had done this, and now they, in 1980, that's not an accurate fairy tale. That's not an accurate description of what happened. There were earlier cases in which the court said, no, we don't think we should do that. And it is true, it changed its mind. But it changed its mind, I think, for very good reasons. This was while I was on the court. And they're likely to continue to do that. In which case, it'll take at least 2-3 years before you can get that done. Now, my suggestion is very simple. You know, it's past the House, it's late in the session, you're not going to want to draft amendments and go through this exercise, but you'll be in session again next January. And all you have to do is send this over to the Law Commission and have them take a look at it and come back with a recommendation. The Law Commission wants this. They've already drafted something. Now, that may not be, Chairman McPherson's may not like that solution. We can come up with something else. But I think that this is clearly a kind of case in which doing it just because 2 or 3 lawyers have gotten together and drafted this, and there's no opposition to it, that therefore it's a good idea. It's not a good idea as it is drafted. Because I'm just as interested as accomplishing Mr. Hinkle's and the other people's objectives and the Department of Justice's objectives as they are. I'm just concerned that this is going to be more of a setback than an advantage. That's why, otherwise I wouldn't have come. I mean, I have no interest in this except to try to help you get the job done.
Appreciate that, and thank you for coming to Senate Judiciary. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
If you actually read that Keller's case, you'll find that, and this came as a surprise to me, the court began, as the Judge Durham's opinion, began with a quotation from an article I wrote 2 years ago on this very topic. And
why do you like that case so much?
If anybody actually reads that article, you'll see that I have essentially made this recommendation that I'm making to you today in the very article that the Supreme Court cited as its authority. So I would say that there is a better way to do this than this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we get Charlie Hinkle back just for about a minute and a half here? How do you respond to the issue about if a judgment is handed down, for example, a monetary judgment, where the person, if this were carried forward and that person no longer was the person affected by the ruling, and yet would that person benefit from the judgment?
This is Charles Hinkle. Madam Chair, that's really a different issue. When you have a monetary judgment in favor of a particular plaintiff whose rights have been violated, the mootness issue never arises because that judgment for money damages keeps the case from being moot. The cases that we are talking about are solely the cases in which there's a declaratory judgment or injunctive relief that is being sought. Because if a particular litigant has sued a school board or any other local agency of government and gotten a monetary judgment because his or her rights were violated a month ago, a year ago, that will never become moot. The court will always decide that.
Thank you for putting that on the record. Appreciate it. Okay, anybody else wanted to testify on this? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2324, and I think we will carry this over till tomorrow. Now, we will open a... House Bill 2134, do a public hearing on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2134A permits ex parte orders for interception of wire, electronic, and oral communications when there is probable cause that the individual committed or is about to commit racketeering and the location in question will be used to plan the crime or is open to the public or owned by the suspect. It also authorizes ex parte orders. By ex parte, it means just the government showing up, essentially, without the defendant knowing, permitting electronic interception excuse me, when there is reasonable suspicion that the person whose communication is to be intercepted is committing, has committed, or is about to commit the crime, and there's substantial risk of death, serious physical injury, or sexual assault, an interception is necessary to protect the safety of the person, and other investigative procedures have been tried and failed and are unlikely to succeed, and four, the person suspected of committing the crime and whose oral communication is to be intercepted is identified. It enacts a sunset provision for these new provisions that would occur on January 2nd, 2012. And I should also let the committee know that this bill was subject to a work group that was formed in the House, and I believe these are the consensus product of the members.
Okay. We have Michael Swanson signed up. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slauson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice, assigned to the Criminal Justice Division in the Organized Crime Section. Here to testify in support of House Bill 2134A. As mentioned, House Bill 2134A is a result of a consensus reached among a work group consisting of the Oregon Department of Justice, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the American Civil Liberties Union, the City of Portland, and the Oregon Association of the Chiefs of Police. I know that in the room here today, there is a representative of the OCDLA and a representative of the ACLU that both participated in the work group. House Bill 2134A modifies Oregon law relating to the interception of communications in three ways. In each modification, law enforcement is required to have court authorization before intercepting a communication. First change is to add racketeering to the list of crimes for which a court may authorize law enforcement to intercept a communication when law enforcement is not a party to the conversation. So that's when you intercept a telephone conversation, which would be a wiretap, or you use a bugging device. Under current law, there's a pretty high hurdle for getting a wiretap order or a bugging device order. To get that order, a court must find that there's probable cause to believe that a certain list of crimes has occurred, that the communication that's going to be intercepted will yield evidence of that crime, and that law enforcement has basically done everything it could and other investigative techniques to develop sufficient evidence, or can at least demonstrate to the court that any further investigative techniques would be unfruitful or would be too dangerous. It's only until law enforcement has sort of jumped over that hurdle can you obtain this type of order. And then once you have, the court itself has to approve of what they call a minimization policy or provision, where those listening in on the conversations have to minimize the amount of conversation that they hear that's not related to criminal activity, and that's something the court has to approve. As I mentioned in the written testimony, racketeering is a tool that's used by law enforcement to disrupt and dismantle large-scale criminal organizations. And this would allow law enforcement to intercept communications of individuals involved in that type of enterprise. And only in those circumstances, because of what's required by the wiretap law, only in those situations when there's nothing else to be done. There's no other way to get at this organization but to use this tool. That's the first change. The second change is sort of a technical change to some of the language in the statute currently. It talks about where you can put a bugging device. Right now, it wasn't clear whether or not you could put it in a public place or whether or not the person whose communication was going to be intercepted had to have some sort of proprietary interest in the location where it was to be bugged. This changes that to say that it can be in a public place provided that there's probable cause to believe that the location is being used or is about to be used in the planning or commission of a crime. The final change talks about allowing law enforcement to intercept or actually record in this context, record face-to-face communications when the law enforcement officer or somebody working with the law enforcement officer is having a conversation with somebody. It allows you to record those conversations when there's reasonable suspicion to believe that a crime is being committed, that the circumstances present a substantial risk of death, serious physical injury, or sexual assault to the officer or a person assisting the officer, and that interception is necessary for the protection of the officer or the person assisting. And again, same as what we had with the other provision dealing with wiretap and bugging, that the officer is exhausted every other investigative technique available. This provision would apply in those situations when the officer is trying to develop probable cause, can't quite get there, knows that doing a face-to-face, wearing a body wire might yield more evidence, but has reasonable officer safety concerns that the court's approved of, and this is the only other technique that's available. Thank you for hearing my testimony on this. I urge that you pass 2134A with a due pass recommendation. Excuse me. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for working so hard to get consensus with the ACLU and the defense lawyers and the DAs. Questions from the committee? Okay. Nobody else has signed up. Anybody else want to say something? Okay. Close the public hearing. Open the work session. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2134 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2134 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Krasanski, would you like to carry this? Okay, now we're going to switch councils. And while we're switching councils, I will announce that we are carrying over again House Bill 2333. We will eventually get to that bill, but not yet. I know. Let's see. I think we'll open a very quick public hearing on. Is Representative Nathanson here?
No.
Why don't you call her and we'll tell her it'll be about 20 minutes. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on HJR 49 and HJR 50. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, HJR 49 and 50 come to you from the Committee on the Judiciary at the request of the Attorney General. HJR 49 amends Section 2, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, grants the victim the right to assert a claim in a pending case or seek a writ of mandamus if no case is pending. HJR, and you have before you the A4 amendments. HJR 50 amends the Section 43, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, grants the victim the right to assert a claim in a pending case or seek a writ of mandamus if no case is pending, allows the victim to request assistance of the prosecuting attorney to assert the victim's rights. We have the A5 amendments in front of you, Madam Chairman, as appointed.
Okay. And we have signed up on this the Attorney General, Steve Dole, and Doug Baloof on both of these measures. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Hardy Myers, Attorney General, for the record. I've had distributed to the committee a written statement, which I will try to abbreviate somewhat. I know your time is limited, but noting first that the current Bill of Rights of the Constitution, Article 1, Sections 42 and 43, establish various rights of crime victims in the Oregon Constitution, and this was by a vote on measures referred by the legislature in 1999. We note those rights include the right to be present, be heard at critical junctures, the right upon request to be consulted about plea negotiations. Now, the reason these joint resolutions are before the Assembly is that victims cannot currently enforce any of these rights because the constitutional provisions provide that an assertion of a victim's rights cannot invalidate a court ruling or suspend a criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding. And no remedial structure could be effective if there were no ability to overturn a ruling of a court dealing with a victim's rights, or to perhaps suspend the proceedings for an interlocutory appeal if that were prescribed under the applicable procedures. So the measures would first qualify those two restrictions to make them consistent with the effective assertion of a victim's rights, and then they empower victims individually to seek remedies by due course of law for violations of their constitutional rights. And then the resolutions authorize the Assembly to enact statutes that provide the details of that remedial structure, including reasonable limitations on the time allowed for filing claims and the circumstances in which interlocutory appeal is allowed. And so the Constitution is kept clear of a lot of unnecessary detail with respect to the remedial process itself. That is left to the Assembly to determine. And I have committed that if the Assembly refers the measures to the people, I will convene a working group to join me in developing proposed legislation for the Assembly's consideration to implement the resolutions should they be approved by the people. I also think it's important to note that the resolutions continue the current provisions of Sections 42 and 43 of the Constitution, Article 1, that prevent a recovery of money damages for violation, and the current provisions that prevent an assertion of victims' rights from invalidating an accusatory instrument, an indictment or information, from invalidating a conviction or juvenile adjudication, or from terminating any criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding. So these current restraints on the effect of an assertion of a violation and a determination that a violation occurred, those constraints that have been in place since 1999 are maintained. And the resolutions also provide that no claim for a right established in the two sections shall suspend a criminal or juvenile proceeding if such a suspension would violate a right of a criminal defendant or alleged youth offender guaranteed by the Oregon or federal constitutions. And I think probably speedy trial would be the most likely intersection between a delay in the proceedings for the resolution of an issue of rights violation, but might not be the only one. The measures before you were amended by the House Judiciary Committee, and those amendments were recommended by a working group I convened after the initial public hearing on the joint resolutions in the House. And that work group, as I've noted here, included the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and Crime Victims United. I might say it also included the American Civil Liberties Union, the Department of Justice, of course. Both Deputy Peter Shepard and I personally participated. Both CBU and the OCDLA support referral of the resolutions to the people. I believe it's correct to say the ACLU is neutral on that question, but as far as I know, not opposed. And during the work group's efforts, the OCDLA reserved the right to oppose ultimate approval of the resolutions, and all of the participants in the work group agreed to honor and respect that reservation. So to sum up, then, a right without a remedy is illusory. And the HJR 49A and 50A grant victims the authority to realize the promises of Sections 42 and 43. And I very sincerely hope that the committee will report these resolutions to the Senate with a recommendation that they be referred to the people. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. In HJR 49, when you talk about on starting on line 17, where we refer to relief and the establishment of reasonable limitations on the time allowed for bringing claims, is timing the only thing that you can put reasonable limitations on? Could you say what's meant by that section?
Well, those are intended to be, I would say, exemplary examples of the kind of detail that the legislature would be authorized to address in spelling out the details of the remedial process. And I think probably those would be the two most important limitations that aren't otherwise stated in the Constitution that I already noted as far as the effect of remedial proceeding.
What do you mean the two most important limitations?
The two examples that are given here of the right to establish reasonable limitations on the time allowed and authorization for expedited and interlocutory considerations of claims are two examples of the kinds of details. But the limitation on the time for filing claims is in addition to the limitations that are already in the Constitution that I referred to earlier. The fact that a determination that a right was violated can't invalidate an indictment. It can't invalidate a conviction. And so those particular restrictions remain in place.
So this is not meant to be an exclusive list, but an exemplary list.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I think the only question that would have to be assessed, apart from the policy issue, the only question that would have to be assessed in constitutional terms as the legislature developed the remedial structure is, does a particular provision, the legislature is considering statutory provision, does it somehow collide with some provisions of the Constitution itself? But certainly the intention is subject to those limitations in the Constitution itself to give the legislature maximum authority to determine how it wants that remedial process to operate. The choice, to the greatest extent possible, is intended to be left with the members of the Assembly.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Who's next?
Mr. Dole.
Mr. Dole.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United. I'm also a member of the Attorney General's Advisory Committee for the Oregon Crime Victims Rights Compliance Implementation Project and the Attorney General's Task Force on Restitution. I have provided you with written my testimony in writing, so I'll try to be brief with my comments. I first want to say this. I thank you for holding this hearing today on HJR 49 and 50. And it's an honor to have Attorney General Myers as a requester on HJR 49 and 50 along with Crime Victims United. Crime Victims United strongly supports these two joint resolutions and asks you to pass the resolutions out of committee and onto the floor of the Senate for a vote. This really is the third wave, if you will, of the victims' rights movement, starting in the 1980s with Bob and Dee Dee Koons, who founded Crime Victims United and placed ballot measures 8 and 10 in the mid-80s that provided crime victims with statutory victims' rights provisions, and through the 90s in which crime victims' rights became enshrined in the Oregon Constitution as constitutional rights and now moving towards standing for crime victims. HJR 49 and 50 will allow victims to defend their constitutional rights on appeal when violated. Presently, there are 34 states that have adopted constitutional rights for crime victims, and only two of those states, Oregon and Virginia, are without standing a remedy for those rights. In hindsight, it was with probably an overabundance of caution that the issues of standings were not placed in the original Measure 40 or the subsequent measures referred by the legislature after Measure 40 was taken out by the Supreme Court. However, it is notable that the members of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, who were most concerned about this issue at the time, stand with us today in support of HJR 49 and 50. The reason for HJR 49 and 50 is simply that the current rights are illusory, as the Attorney General stated, without remedy if they are violated, and they must be placed in the Constitution because currently the Constitution prohibits remedy. I have provided in my written comments some examples of cases and case examples of why we need to have standing and remedy. I've also included in page 3 of my written testimony part of the report, page 66 of the report, from the Crime Victims Needs Assessment report by Portland State University that illuminates the problem of enforcement and standing on crime victims' rights issues. In summary, we spend lots of time in this building concerning ourselves with the rights of the accused and convicted, as we should. My mentors in the crime victims movement, Bob and Dee Dee Koons, once said, without victims, there would be no need for a criminal justice system. If we could return all the property, if we could heal all the injuries, if we could raise the dead. But we all know that this is not possible. So now we ask you to address the rights of crime victims and standing within the courts. And all we are asking is for remedy for victims whose rights have been violated. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Senator Barr.
And I'm not saying this question is for you, Bob, but maybe I should wait. But it seems that, and then you guys, you know, worked on this as a work group, but I'm just reading it. And you got, when you start on page 2, line 6, with a sentence that nothing in this section is intended to cause any cause of action for compensation or damages. Normally this section would be used to invalidate an accusatory instrument. And then you want to remove ruin of the court, and then also remove suspendor. So it seems like you're creating a conflict in this same section, that by not removing that sentence, but yet saying below, you have a right of action.
Where are you referring to, Senator?
On page 2, on 49. Page 2, starting in line 6.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Barr, I don't think there's a conflict. The removal of the reference, as I said earlier, the removal of a reference of invalidating a ruling of a court or that prohibits suspending a proceeding, criminal or juvenile delinquency proceedings, those are the amendments that are necessary in order to make a remedial process possible. Without those, removing those prohibitions, you can't have an effective remedial structure, because it's going to involve overturning rulings of courts in relation to victims' rights. It may involve suspending proceedings. But if you'll go on, you'll see the language says on line 10, except as otherwise provided in subsections 3 and 4 of this section, nothing in this section may be used to invalidate a ruling or of a court or to suspend any criminal or juvenile delinquency proceedings. So it's really intended to lift those prohibitions sufficiently to permit an effective remedial structure to come into being in the first place. If those two provisions weren't in the Constitution, Senator Beyer, the ones that were being removed or qualified, might not be necessary to amend the Constitution at all, but in any event, having removed those, we felt it was appropriate to go on and provide certain other minimum provisions, including a clear authorization to the legislature to undertake the detailing of that process, and then very importantly the protection about not allowing a suspension to violate a constitutional right.
Well, I guess, like I said, you guys know a lot more about this than me, but it seems like you could have accomplished the same thing rather than adding about 20 lines to the Constitution, just removing that one sentence completely, and then allow the legislature to craft remedies.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I think probably the first, there was agreement at the beginning that certainly at a minimum that had to occur to deal with those two provisions, but as the discussions and the considerations went further, we began to feel that it would be the best approach to spell out in somewhat more detail the different provisions that now represent the total proposal. And we've been very careful to try to keep those to a minimum, I would say, and to try to be sure that each one we think is justifiable as an addition to the Constitution. And I think really that has been accomplished.
Senator Barr, can you tell me specifically what you thought could be removed and avoid the extra language?
Well, I was just looking at the sentence that starts on line 6, page 2, with nothing. Nothing in this section is intended to create any cause of action for compensation or damage, nor may this section be used to validate an accusatory instrument, ruling of the court, conviction or adjudication, or otherwise suspend or terminate any criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding at any point after the case is commenced or on appeal. It seems to me that's the sentence that it keeps the legislature from addressing and doing this legislatively.
Madam Chair?
Oh. Counsel?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, you are correct. If you took that out, that would solve that problem, but it would be much beyond that, too, because it would potentially allow someone to sue for civil damages and all along those lines. So, for example, if the victim contended that they weren't given the opportunity to be heard, they may wind up suing the court, they might wind up suing the district attorney, And I think the original intent on this, when it was enacted both times, was to have a very limited remedy. And I believe what this amendment does is it allows you to challenge the ruling of the court, but it would not allow you to bring a cause of action, say, for money damages against any of the parties I just mentioned. I think that's correct. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, Council and Senator Beyer, the intention is to continue those restraints on the effect of a proceeding relating to a violation, and to withdraw the existing restraints only to the extent necessary to affect a basic remedial process. But we are not advocating that that process be allowed to invalidate an accusatory instrument, conviction, juvenile adjudication, used to recover money damages. Those present restraints, we believe, should be kept in place, and that's what this measure proposes to do.
Senator Brzezinski?
I guess for clarification on what the council said, I just want to put it on the record. It really allows for the victim to have recourse when a court renders a decision that may be against their rights as victims and does not have any interference as to any other parts of the proceedings. So this is a means now where there wasn't before, where a victim could cry foul, or my rights have been violated, and they would have a means to have redress with all the confines and restrictions that are presently there.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, that is correct. And I think that a statutory spelling out of this process would probably include a clarification of what exactly a court should do if a particular right were violated.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up, I think maybe an example, Attorney General Myers, would be if you had a particular judge who seemed to routinely make decisions that went against what a victim's right could be impacted. These type of decisions would allow for an injunction against that that judge, or some type of mandamus to make certain that he or she is respecting the rights that have been given to the victims.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, yes, that's correct. And there also, I think that a statutory spelling out of these provisions would address how a victim should assert a particular violation. What is the procedure the victim should use? That choice is left to the legislature ultimately if it wishes. Because the provision currently says a victim may assert a claim for a right established in the section in a pending case by a mandamus proceeding if no case is pending, or as otherwise provided by law. So ultimately, it's left to you to determine, the Assembly to determine, what's the process for seeking redress. And what should, and as I say, I would expect that statutory structure would spell out probably what is a court expected to do, supposed to do, if a particular right is violated.
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. Other questions? Thank you. Mr. Blue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, honorable senators, for the opportunity to appear today. My name is Doug Ballouf. I'm professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law School and director of the National Crime Victim Law Institute. I've been cited by the United States Senate Judiciary Committee as a leading authority on crime victim law. I've authored the only book in the field entitled Victims in Criminal Procedure, written numerous scholarly articles, and consulted with Congress on the drafting of the 2004 Federal Crime Victims' Rights Act. Crime victims' rights in Oregon are presently unenforceable. Thus, the present version of Oregon's constitutional victims' rights are illusory rights. Real rights are rights which can be enforced in and defined by appellate courts. Perhaps the most important case ever decided by the United States Supreme Court, Marbury versus Madison, asserted that rights without remedy are not rights at all. From a national perspective, Oregon lags behind the federal government and the majority of states because in Oregon, victims cannot enforce their rights. Federal law gives standing to victims to enforce their rights. The vast majority of 34 states with constitutional rights explicitly or implicitly allow for standing. The primary reason for providing standing to victims is to accord victims meaningful rights. but there are constitutional reasons and reasons of judicial order that also make it important that this bill be passed to the floor. First, the lack of victim standing makes trial courts rather than appellate courts the ultimate arbiter of rights. In America, this is an upside-down process. Each trial court can arrive at its own unique conclusions about the meaning of any given right. Moreover, trial courts can apply their disparate interpretations without fear of correction or reversal. The result can be different rights for different victims based on which trial judge is selected to preside over the case. Second, we presently provide victims to enforce certain statutory rights, such as evidentiary privileges, but deny enforcement for rights of constitutional stature, rights that are arguably more important than statutory provisions. This makes little legal sense. Third, denying victim standing prevents the kind of adversity that is critical to the adequate litigation of rights. Our legal system is founded on the idea that adverse sides to an issue will adequately frame the issue for an appellate court. Without standing, victims' rights can only be contested on review by parties that have no personal stake in the right. Fourth, when prosecutors possess exclusive control over victims' rights, such a structure provides fertile ground for conflicts of interest for prosecutors. Prosecutors represent the public interest, not victims' interests. Moreover, when prosecutors violate victims' rights, they cannot, nor should we expect them reasonably to seek review and reversal of their own actions. Finally, victims' rights are destructive to the traditional model. Victims' rights without standing are destructive to the traditional model of civil rights, all which have remedy. And in my written testimony, I won't go through it, but I have a section in there that shows how modest and small the impact of victim standing is on the courts, on the burden of the courts, and it's very small. But it's important to note that even though the court opinions are few, they nevertheless serve two important purposes. First, even one opinion can clarify the scope and meaning of victims' rights for literally hundreds of cases. Second, the potential of reconsideration or review provides incentive to government actors to be scrupulous in honoring the rights. In conclusion, an amendment to the Constitution is needed to provide these meaningful rights, to bring the rights into Constitution with constitutional norms for civil liberties, to bring them within conventional judicial structure. For all these reasons, I urge you to send the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much, Professor Blue. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one more witness signed up, Jane Downing, from the Mid Valley Crisis Center. And I would ask you to be very brief. We're kind of under a time crunch.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service serving Marion County. And I will be very brief. I've provided you with written testimony. All I would like to say is you're getting all the background information from other folks. I just want to bring forward the voice of victims. We work with tens of thousands of victims every year, and what we hear consistently from them is that they feel as though they don't have the same rights as the criminal. They don't feel that their voices are always heard in the process. And so I just want to bring that very human touch to this, that if you need to hear stories about what's going on with the folks that we work with, I'm always happy to provide those, and you can call me anytime, and we can talk about that. But just for the sake of time, I'm not going to say any more other than I just encourage you to pass this on to the floor. It's so important that folks are out there listening to the voices of victims and survivors of all the different crimes that go on in the state. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on this. It is my intention to move these bills, but we will roll them over till tomorrow. And now we will talk about Representative Nicholson's bill, which is open a public hearing on House Bill 3369. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3369 comes from Representative Nicholson, requires that a county that has a local public safety coordinating council to publish annually a summary of the program services and budget changes that the county made in response to the public safety coordinating council's recommendations, requires the report to be provided to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission requires the county to fill a vacancy in the Public Safety Coordinating Council within 3 months after vacancy becomes vacant or soon as thereafter possible. Requires the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to add to this comprehensive long-range plan for coordinating state criminal justice system the effective utilization of local public safety coordinating councils.
Welcome, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I did not bring a gaggle of witnesses. I'll be the only one speaking to my bill in front of you today. Local public safety coordinating councils have been working since 1977 to help better organize our local public safety systems. I had the privilege of serving on my local public safety coordinating council, or as it's called in the building here sometimes, LPSC. I served on my local one in Lane County to observe and participate firsthand in the benefits of collaborative work, interagency discussion, and that sort of cross-pollination that they bring. As a state representative, I would now like to help the local councils or LPSCs to achieve even greater potential. Collaboration, such as what is brought by local LPSCs, can lead to improved service and cost-effective solutions. Collaboration spurs creative ideas for joint projects and new ways of doing business. In this building, we often call on collaboration as a way to squeeze more out of less and to get even better results with resources that we don't have to keep pace with increasing demands. Public safety is the third largest expense for the state, behind education and human services. In the criminal justice system, there are separate jurisdictions at different levels of government with parallel and overlapping responsibilities, and the activities of each can directly impact the work or results of the other. County sheriffs and jails, city police, parole and probation, district attorneys, judges, and public defenders. And casting the net even wider beyond that, it involves youth advocates, mental health providers, elected and appointed officials, advisory groups, and nonprofit organizations. This network could function with fantastic results designed as a criminal justice system, but often we hear about it not being designed as a system. It's really just a labyrinth. Without coordination, these agencies can develop programs that become unrelated from one another and at cross purposes, and sometimes they're even competing for the same public money and community donations. Lawmakers thought it was important to get the criminal justice system components working together, so important that in the 70s the legislature codified this as ORS 423.560. That statute is the one that set up these LPSCs. They were established with the task of helping to organize and coordinate the activities and policy among the different criminal justice entities and to provide recommendations for more efficient and effective use of public safety resources. The law provides instructions for who should be at the table and little other administrative or organizational demands or advice. These local councils have been meeting. Some of them have been brainstorming and, in times, reinventing systems. Good things are happening, but not uniformly across the state.
Representative Nakinson, could I ask you to summarize?
I love
this bill.
I will.
I'd like you to summarize.
I will. This bill would help the LPSCs who have lapsed into a dormant state come to life again. It would help give them a pat on the back and a little bit of encouragement for those people who help organize and call the meetings to say, we know you can do great things. In fact, the legislature asked you to. Now we're asking you to make it real. Give us a report on what you've done, publish it, and we're going to help you move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your coming. And I'm also a member of my local, a newly appointed member of my local LPSC up in Multnomah County. So I know the good work these committees do and look forward to participating. Are there any questions for Representative Nathanson? Thank you for coming in. I hate to cut you off. We just have such a busy schedule.
I understand. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3369 and open a work session on House Bill 3369. Senator
Byrne.
Yes.
I'm on the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Podzanski has moved House Bill 3369 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Do you hate this bill?
What?
Do you hate this bill?
No, I was just
in conversation. I just thought
okay. I'm going to vote for the bill. I just was wondering why it drew so many no votes in the House. If anybody knew why, I mean, it would fail the first time on the floor, and that
It failed on the floor.
It failed on the floor, and then it was reconsidered, and it passed the second time.
Well, maybe they were just having fun that day.
I believe one of the issues was considered was whether or not this was some type of quote-unquote unfunded mandate. The representative and I spoke earlier today, and I think that was one of the concerns. She was wondering if it didn't. This is something that we've already are requiring to occur, and now we're just asking for something to, you know, show the paper trail as to what they're doing, and if they're not actually meeting on a regular basis, that they have a obligation to reappoint, get people going, and not let it sit dormant. So I thought I didn't think it was a problem.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, and that may be where some places they're not working, but some places they're working well, and I'm not sure they need to be doing more reporting, and I'm not sure we necessarily should be getting coordination, because each county, each community does have its own unique set of issues and unique way of dealing with it. So, you know, just from my own perspective of my home and knowing full well the work they do, this is just going to add more reporting, and isn't, I don't think, going to make them any better, because they're already very good. So,
thank you. Any other discussion? Do we need a roll call, Senator Cruz? We need a roll call.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Aye.
Senator Walker? Aye. Vice Chair Byers? Aye. Chair Burton? Aye. Senator Prusansky, would you like to carry it?
Sure.
Oh, I will take that gavel back. I guess I better declare a potential conflict of interest since I am a member of LIPSC. So, Senator Prusansky will carry this. And we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2190. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2190 comes at the request of Governor Kulongowski for the Department of Human Services, and it requires the Oregon to follow the federal requirements concerning criminal records, background checks for people applying to be foster parents and adoptive parents applies to anyone else residing in the home effective October 1, 2008. It requires a local citizens review board to make written findings concerning whether the Department of Human Services made reasonable efforts to place child as appropriate to an interstate placement, requires Oregon courts to share information with the court in other state in order to facilitate interstate placements. Chair members of the committee, you also have a -5 and -6 amendments in front of you that relate to a totally different issue. I had discussed these amendments in the hallway. They come from Senator Walker. The -5, the -6 were in response to her -5s by the Oregon State Bar. Paul Sassy is here, of course.
Wait. What? The 5 and 6?
A5 and the A6. The A5 were out yesterday. The Oregon State Bar Family Law Section had some questions with the amendments. Mm-hmm. They came here yesterday, and with Sybil Hebb and I, we sat down, put together a language that they thought would work better. We met outside the hallway with General Caldwell. I believe he is comfortable with the A6 amendments, as is Senator Walker.
I am. So the A5s are toast.
Right. And if I could just briefly tell you.
To put it in plain language, we passed a bill about plain language statute.
You need to use those words, Council.
Plain language? No.
Toast.
I'm a lawyer. I'm challenging
that. There's toast.
On page 7, lines 6 through 15, sets forth basically what this amendment does.
Okay. Senator Walker, did you want to say anything else about the -6 amendment before we hear the testimony on the underlying bill?
No, Madam Chair. Other than, I'll be a classic lawyer. No, I have nothing else to say other than I'm okay with the agreement we've reached on the -6, and we're accomplishing what we discussed the other day about custody arrangements for deployed military personnel. General Caldwell's happy with it, and I'm glad we found a vehicle to take care of it.
Okay, and it's my understanding that this bill is necessary to get to comply with federal requirements, and the penalties would be severe if we don't have the underlying bill.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And since everyone seems to like the A6 amendments, we have Paul Sassy signed up and Harry Gilmore. If you want to say something very brief, are they still here?
Yes, sir.
Welcome.
Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Ask a question of counsel.
Please.
I have a letter in my file from Executive Director of the Linn County CASA in opposition to the bill. Original bill, this was in January. It was sent to me. I see the bill was extensively
amended in the House, were the local costs involved? And do you know if they've been, what their concerns were?
Chair, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, it's the first I've heard about local costs. I can't answer one way or the other. Harry Gilmore is here, as is Mickey Cerise. Maybe they could better address it than I could. You're right, the bill has been significantly amended since its original version. I really can't answer that.
Mm-hmm. It's a cut and stop, basically, isn't it?
Okay.
Madam Chairman of the Committee, I have to admit I have not heard from anyone since we passed it.
As I said, the letter was written to me in January, so I...
It would seem to me that we would have heard something about it if... why don't we hear from Mr. Gilmore and Mr. Sossi?
The bill still exists.
No. Mr. Gilmore, right?
I'm Mr. Sossi.
You're Mr. Sossi, okay. Is Mr. Gilmore here because...
Yes, sir.
You would be more likely to respond to Senator Beyer's comment, I think.
It's a different bill. I mean, if you look at the A and Girls versus the original bill, the summary's been completely...
it's a gotten stuff.
There's only one statute that's similar between the two. And that's why I was wondering.
I think this is a gotten stuff, wasn't it?
It's a gotten stuff.
Pretty much.
Is it completely gotten stuff or just partially?
The House Amendment eliminates the entire bill and starts over. So.
Just gotta love those kind of bills.
Yeah, we do love those bills, but we're used to doing it ourselves. We're not used to seeing them from others. Welcome. If you could be very brief, we'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name's Harry Gilmore, and I'm the manager of the Technical Assistance Unit for the Children, Adults, and Families Division of the Department of Human Services. And yes, you're correct. This bill was originally... written, grew out of a legislative concept developed by the Department of Human Services. That was the concept that was opposed by CASA, and the department opted not to go forward with that concept. Because of the relating clause of the bill, we were able to use it to move forward the language that addresses the changes in federal requirements, and it is that portion of the bill that we support. And I provide a written testimony that goes into more detail on the specifics of each of the changes that this makes to Oregon statute to bring it into alignment and compliance with the changes in federal regs. And unless you want me to, I'm not going to go into a description of each of those changes. I will say this, though, that they're minor changes. They will not have a fiscal impact on the department, and they're things that we can... that will not have a major impact on child welfare practice. They are all related to child welfare practice and how we administer our programs and manage child welfare cases. As I said, these changes will bring us into compliance with changes in federal regulations that are tied to Title 4E and Title 4B funding, of which our programs and services substantially depend. It's roughly totals about $2.5 million in total funds and about $1.3 million, I should say $135 million. It's $250 million total funds, and $135 million of that is Title 4E and Title 4B federal funds. And more specifically, this substantially supports our foster care program and our adoption assistance programs. As for the amendment proposed to the bill, this is something that does not have a direct impact on child welfare, and we're neutral on the amendment. However, we passage of the engrossed language of the bill is critical to us being able to continue our Title 4E and 4B claims.
Thank you. I think it's the first time I've ever heard DHS come in and say there wasn't a fiscal. Thank you. Okay.
Actually, there be without passage, so.
That is correct.
Mr. Sossi.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Paul Sossi. I'm a local attorney here practicing in Salem. I'm here on behalf of the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar to speak in favor of the A6 Amendment. What this statute does is amend ORS 107.135. That statute is the mechanism by which a court implements a change of custody between two parents after it's made a custody determination. A problem exists that I understand Senator Walker has spoken to, and that is if the custodial parent is in the military and is deployed, what are we going to do with the child? We have a statute, ORS 109.056, that allows a military service person who is called up on active duty to delegate on a temporary basis that parent's parental rights. And what we also have a statute, 107.149, that says it is the policy of this state to encourage parents to share parental rights and responsibilities. We have a potential conflict, of course, because if a parent who has custody is going off to Iraq and places the child with the non-custodial parent, as would Oregon policy would favor, first thing the non-custodial parent does is move to modify and say, you're gone, I want custody. What this provision does is say that the mere act of you placing the custodial child being placed with the non-custodial parent because you're being deployed in and of itself does not constitute a ground to change custody. And that's what it does. It's a nice little statute because it has a mechanism already in place in ORS 107.135 that says that if the non-custodial parent has physical possession of the child, you don't have to pay child support. So it takes care of all the little loose ends. Because it dovetails with 109.056, it describes what a temporary placement is, it describes how long it will be, and it works nicely with all the other statutes.
Okay, and thank you for your work on this, and thank you, Senator Walker, for being flexible and working with everyone to bring this to us. General Caldwell, do you want to say about 30 seconds worth of kumbaya on this? And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're pleased with the amendment. For the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. We appreciate the committee's indulgence in taking the time to do this because I think it's an important piece of legislation that we can perhaps prevent some of the problems that we've had before. I think the amendment, what it does, and I'm not an attorney either, I practice temporary law once in a while in my office, but certainly not out in the real world. And I would say that if that's, I'm going to trust the attorneys here to say it's 1 year plus, or the time of the deployment plus 30 days is what this law will allow the soldier to do. So if that's the case, and I have no reason to believe it isn't, then I think we're completely satisfied that we can do the right thing with our deployed people who have this circumstance. So again, thank you, Senator Walker and Chair Burdick for making sure we could get this accomplished.
Thank you, and thank you also for your flexibility. Questions? Close the public hearing. Open the work session. Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I move the A6 amendment to House Bill 2190.
Senator Walker has moved the dash A6 amendment to House Bill 2190. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2190 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2190 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. And you get to carry the whole darn thing, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, now we're going to ask for the committee's indulgence for at least 5 minutes to at least start a public hearing on House Bill 3407.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3407 comes to you from Representative Galizio, and it exempts from disclosure unless the public interest requires otherwise the home address and telephone numbers contained in the voter registration records of a district attorney, a deputy district attorney, assistant attorney general, designated by the attorney general if the person requesting information not be disclosed. Exempts from public disclosure unless the public interest requires otherwise the names of public safety officers and district attorneys, assistant attorneys contained in the county real property records. And chairman of the committee, there are two sets of amendments in front of you, the dash 3 and the dash 4 and also the dash 6. I can go through those.
I want only the amendment that applies to the district attorneys.
That would be the dash 3, Madam Chairman of the committee.
Describe those, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that it basically does two things. Going over to page 4, lines 42, it inserts, after by requested, the number of the public safety officer or attorney contained in the voter registration records
in two places. So it would read, if requested.
Oh, wait. Why don't we have Mr. Neely sum it up so that we can get the substance of Kevin Neely and Brian DeLashmit.
For the record, Brian DeLashmit representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. The original bill was a cleanup bill of a bill that was passed virtually unanimously last session at the request of the Oregon Council of Police Associations. It just dealt with whether or not a public citizen could, in fact, call the tax assessment office or the county elections office and get the address, telephone number, or email address of a public safety officer. And we attempted to block that. That bill passed. What happened was the counties came back to us and said, well, the way our computer systems are set up, we'd actually prefer to be able to block it in a different manner rather than the person asking the name and the address being blocked. They would just as soon not release the name or any information about that. And because their tax and assessment records are based upon property addresses, then they continue to track via property records. The bill, however, has now evolved into two additional groups wanting the same protections, the district attorneys and the assistant AGs as well. And we were happy to include that in this bill. We felt it was essential that as we proceed with people wanting this protection, that it be in the same statute, handled the same in the same manner. And so that's the basis for the bill.
Okay, and it's my understanding you also switched all of these to the conditional section of the public records law.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the original bill from last session was in 192.502, which is there is no public interest requirement for that, so that no one could ever get that information. It's now in 501, which there is a condition requires that it be blocked unless there's a public interest in disclosing that. And so, again, we try to incorporate it all in one place. And the Dash 3 amendments, in fact, complete that revision because even as it came over from the House, some of it was still in 502 and most of it was 501, and the Dash 3s move it over.
Okay, Mr. Neely, I assume you're here to talk about the Dash 3 amendments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I am here to talk about the amendments. Again, I think Mr. DeLashmit and Mr. Taylor have very accurately described the bill. What I can tell you is we had two bills working on parallel courses. Mr. DeLashmit's was a little bit of a cleanup. Mine was an addition. This is the amalgam of those two bills. Again, it addresses a very serious concern the district attorneys have about their safety. I have a story here that I'm going to not read to you today, though it is a very compelling story that is two paragraphs or less.
Will you be turning it
I
in?
I will be turning
okay,
it into the record. But the story basically says that about a month ago we had a Lane County deputy district attorney who very narrowly escaped having he and his family be subjected to a very well-orchestrated effort to kill them. And the way that the perpetrator got the information was walked down to the public records or the county offices, called up the address, and was immediately rewarded with it. I want to say three quick things before I conclude my testimony, and they're around the concerns you're going to hear from the tax assessors who are going to be speaking afterwards, after Mr. DeLashmit and I. One, they're going to tell you that this is too hard or too expensive to implement. I'm concerned about that, one, because what's at stake here is the lives of our public safety officers who are out there doing this work to keep our communities safe. Why are we willing to compromise their livelihoods? Why are we willing to compromise their families at a cost? And two, I'm not certain that there really is an exceptional cost here. Already there's a public safety exemption for a certain segment of people that qualify for that exemption that requires their personal information to be redacted from any documentation that comes out. And so already there must be a mechanism to do that. That law has been in effect for many years. Second, they're going to talk to you about this being a slippery slope, that what's to say we don't have doctors or medical professionals coming next to ask for those sorts of exemptions? And I say the answer to that is you folks over the course of the last 30 years, 33 years. Most of these laws came through in the 1973 session. You've afforded two classes of individuals an exemption. The first class is OHSU primate researchers. The second class was the law enforcement officers that you included last time. Beyond that, you have not chosen to include any additional classes. We are very hopeful that you see the need to include the district attorneys and the assistant attorney generals. Again, they're the folks who are often the real face of the prosecution. They're the ones who are on the other side of the table. And finally, they're going to tell you that these things are easy to get otherwise. I can just go over and I can Google this deputy district attorney's name. I can tell you that over the weekend I sat down and I Googled 50 deputy district attorney's names from Multnomah County. I couldn't get the home address of any one of those folks through a fairly comprehensive search process without going to a site that required me to input my visa number and pay a $7 or $6 fee. And again, I think that most of the time, these folks, if they can't get that information relatively easily, their plan will be abandoned and they won't go out and try and identify these folks.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Paul Snyder, Mark Noakes, and Bob Roman. We stayed over time to accommodate you. I appreciate you coming. We're just jam-packed at this time in the session. My apologies.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for your indulgence. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we're appearing in opposition to House Bill 3407. A couple of things I'd like to mention. One is that the -3 and the -4 amendments, I believe, are identical except for one thing. The -4 amendments provide for a fee that can be charged at the discretion of the county governing body, and it says up to $50 or what the actual costs are, whichever is less.
And who is the fee levied on?
That would be imposed upon people other than public safety officers. So it would apply to the district attorneys and the deputy district attorneys and the assistant attorneys general. The reason why it doesn't apply to the public safety officers is that they're already covered by the current law without a fee. But a reason why we would like to provide for a fee is simply because of the concern that Mr. Neely articulated, that a number of people are waiting in line to do the same thing. A lot of people would like to get their records redacted or not subject to public disclosure for a lot of legitimate reasons. The fact is that this costs a significant amount of money depending upon the individual county and the kind of system the county has in place. And I would defer to the other two witnesses to describe to you why that is and how that works. I'd also suggest that the -6 amendments would be valuable to us because in the current A. N. Gross bill, it provides that a county does not have liability for disclosure after an application is filed. It's intended to provide some protections for people who do that inadvertently. Unfortunately, it doesn't apply all to the public employees, the employees of the county governing body or of the assessor and taxation folks. And so that -6 amendment would simply add employees to the category that's already in the bill, and that's counties. Since we have to indemnify and hold harmless our employees anyway, if it doesn't cover them, it really doesn't do us any good. I'd like, Madam Chair, if you would, just to hear the testimony of the next two witnesses as it relates to you, the cost of providing for this kind of redaction.
Okay, I can provide 2 minutes each.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, committee members. My name is Mark Noakes, and I am the Linn County Assessor and Linn County Tax Collector. And thanks to Mr. Neely, he has pretty much given our opinion on what this bill does. But our point of view on this issue is that some thought should be given to the administrative burdens and associated costs that come with the bill. When changes occur, and when I said when they occur in A&T offices, we are often left with no alternatives other than to manually handle the change or change the programming to allow for a change. In either case, this is expensive, and Bob will talk a little bit about that. It becomes more troublesome when we see various groups trying to jump on the bandwagon. And our question is, where does it stop? And that is why the associations I'm representing, the county assessors and the tax collectors would like to see the interim work group formed to explore all options available to all the players, which includes those people who want their records non-disclosable, and then those people who would have to do the redactions, us. Those whose business interests, who aren't represented here today, I don't believe, who rely upon these records being complete and accurate. And finally, someone who can measure the value of these, of those making these redactions, if any, and going through all this trouble when so much information is already on the web. I'll pass on that to Bob.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chairman Burdick, my name is Bob Roman. I'm the Assessment and Tax Manager at Clackamas County, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. If I can beg your indulgence, and I'll do it very quickly, I just want to clarify that a couple of things have been related to the committee that there isn't really agreement on. One is that under the current law, public safety officers are already able to redact some information. In fact, it would be my knowledge that at least 50%, maybe more, of the counties don't agree that public safety officers currently now can have any information suppressed, because that legislation specifically removed county property and lien records from being able to be suppressed. And as you can see in the information we've provided you, assessment and taxation records evidence the liens of $4 billion in taxes annually, and these aren't available any other place. You can't go to the clerk's office to show these. They're available at assessment and taxation offices only. As far as cost, the potential for cost of implementing something like this is in that it's a fragmented approach. We're dealing with small groups of people at a time, which means we have to deal with other groups of people differently. It can impact your computer system and what information you make available to your staff and to the public, obviously. We have thousands, hundreds and thousands of records that are currently available as public records. That deals with past property tax statements, and much of this information contains name and address information. So there could be potentially a significant cost burden. There's also the potential that if you don't make this information available as we do now to the public when they walk in, that we will have to make information about these properties that isn't suppressible, for instance, other information, value, amenities, sizes, things like that, in a different way, and that can impact your customer service and your staffing requirements.
Well, let me ask you a question. You said some of this information is available only through assessment and taxation. Are you saying that if this suppression went into effect, people wouldn't be able to do title searches?
If a title company contacted our office and asked to identify a property by a name that was suppressed, the answer would be no. We would not be able to provide that information. The only way they would be able to secure that information is if they could identify the property in some way, which would mean they would need some prior knowledge of ownership, as by address or by map number.
So are you saying that titles would be compromised?
I'm not saying titles would be compromised. I'm saying that that information may not be available through our office. Trent?
Counsel?
Madam Chairman, I'm a little bit confused here, because the only thing I see being suppressed would be the home address and telephone number. I don't see the name being suppressed.
In this current bill, the public safety officers are asking for the name to be suppressed, along with the district attorneys.
I must be reading something wrong there. I don't see it. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my assumption, a deed or tax record would describe the property and would give the name of the individual. The way I read this, it just wouldn't give their home address and home telephone number. And I'm reading on page 4 of the bill, the bold language, section 31, and I'm also looking at the amendments, too, and I see nothing that takes out the name of or that allows a person to
If you would look at page 8, line approximately 29 or section 31 if requested by a public safety officer as defined in ORS 181610 or by a district attorney or deputy district attorney. The name of the public safety officer or attorney contained in the county real property assessment and taxation records.
Line
33. It's also evidenced in the actual heading of the bill under the summary.
Okay. We're going to have to look into this more, and we are out of time. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3407 and roll it over till tomorrow and roll over everything else that's not been dealt with on the agenda till tomorrow. We are adjourned. Thank you.